Hi, this is Ron Hogan, and you are listening to Life Stories, a Beatrice.com podcast about memoir writers and their lives and their books. And my guest today is Cambry Crewe.
Hello.
So tell us a little bit about your memoir.
My memoir is Burn Down the Ground, and in a nutshell, it is about my life living in a tin shack in the middle of the woods and a trailer that got repossessed with my deaf family, my deaf parents, and my father and my relationship with him now that he's in jail for 20 years for attempted murder. So it's a comedy.
Mm-hmm. What brought you to a point where you wanted to finally tell this story?
I work in the comedy business, and a lot of comedians, when they would find out about my story, they would kind of salivate almost over these awesome stories that I had growing up in the wild, in the woods with these deaf people, because they're always mining their lives for material, their day-to-day lives or their past, to try to find something funny to say on stage. And here I'm sitting on this treasure trove of material and not doing anything with it, and everybody just kept saying, you've got to write a book, you've got to write a book. And I had actually written an essay, a 3,000-word essay for a contest that Glamour magazine was having. I think they still do it, the Real Stories of Your Life or My Life Story or something like that. And I had found out about the contest, but I only had 3 days before the deadline, so I kind of like hurriedly wrote this 3,000-word piece, turned it in, but I think I still missed the deadline. I never got a receipt for the package that I had hand-delivered. So I had written this thing, though, and I felt like, well, I didn't want it to go to waste, so I let some friends read it, and one was Rachel Kramer Bussell. I don't know if you know her, mm-hmm. but she's a writer.
Yep.
And she read it and suggested that I submit it to FreshYarn.com. And Fresh Yarn doesn't really accept new submissions these days, but they still have just an immense library of really remarkable essays by all kinds of people. And so I submitted it to Hillary Carlip there. Hillary read it, liked it, and helped trim it down and clean it up a little bit, and then published it on that site. And from there, it kind of took off. That's where I got an agent through that, and then wrote the proposal, and then got a publisher.
And moving from that point, as you're, you know, basically as you're trying to reconstruct your life, because, I mean, it sounds like, you know, in reading Burn Down the Ground, that this isn't a case where, you know, you hadn't been taking notes all your life. You hadn't been, you know, keeping a journal. So you're kind of having to rely on your own memory and, you know, going back and talking to people.
Yeah, there were a couple of instances throughout my childhood where I did keep journals. And one was a very critical point in time, which is actually when I was about 16. I had just turned 17 years old, and I was dating this 22-year-old sailor, and he had gone away for a tour of duty kind of thing. It wasn't leave or anything, just training or something. So while he was gone, you know, we had just been dating for a few weeks, and when you're a teenager, that's just a tremendous loss. I treated it like he was going to Vietnam or something. And so I promised him I was going to write him every day. And so I kept this journal, very detailed journal of my day-to-day life, from what I ate to what I wear, what I did. And during this critical 2-week period of his absence, my father ended up attacking my mother. Mm-hmm. And I witnessed it, called 911. And that event changed the course of my life forever. But that particular moment, I never kept a diary. But it was just this, it wasn't luck, because my then boyfriend, Rob, was going away, and I think my dad took the opportunity of his absence to really amp up his stalking and harassing of us. So it was just a real key moment that I ended up documenting, and luckily kept the document for all these years. And I still have them. I actually posted a few of them on Flickr for people to read in their entirety. And I'm a teenage girl, so I like watch Witchboard and mm-hmm. eat chicken pot pie and Chinese food from a can and stuff like that, and a gallon of ice cream. And I tell them all this it's just crazy details that have no interest. And I sat there and watched him read it like it was this novel, the Great American Novel or something. Yeah.
And Yeah, as you said, it's during that period when you're taking the journal that that your dad kind of escalates the stalking that he had been doing ever since your parents split up, and it turned into an outright assault.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things you talk about in the memoir, and we should clarify that this is not the assault that lands your father in jail.
No.
That actually happens 20 years later. But it's a crucial period in terms of, I think, the distinction in the way that his assaults were treated. But, you know, I'm trying to do the dates here, but it was in the 80s?
1988.
So yeah. 1988 when he attacks your mother.
Right.
And then about 17 years later, when he attacks his then partner, you know, the differences in the ways that assaults on women were handled, yeah. particularly domestic assaults,
right.
is really crucial.
It's very crucial, and it's actually a very crucial part in our lives right now. The Violence Against Women Act was up for renewal right now, and it was first enacted in 1994, so a good 6 years after the attack on my mom. And so in 88, and also being in Texas, what happened behind a family's closed doors was their business, and the cops weren't really able to enforce much, but also they didn't treat it, they didn't treat me or my mom like victims, honestly. They were a little, just not rude, but just oblivious to how they should treat a young girl who's just witnessed this attack on her mother. They actually had me interpret in sign language to my dad, which is so inappropriate on a couple of levels. I hope that wouldn't happen today because of the Violence Against Women Act, but also the safeguards that it put in place, the act, it definitely helped change the way domestic violence is viewed and treated. Thankfully, and hopefully it'll be renewed as it's up for renewal right now.
Mm-hmm. And also underscores an important quality of the memoir as I was reading it, which is that, I mean, yeah, obviously you're writing about being the hearing child of two deaf parents, and that does play a part in the story, but, you know, it would be incredibly reductive to say that this is a memoir about growing up in a deaf family.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of impossible to write about my life and not mention that my family's deaf, because it's not just my parents. It's my grandparents and my aunts and uncles. Like, I'm one of the few hearing people on my mother's side of the family. So it does play into it, certainly in the way my father's family dealt with his deafness and the way he grew up impacted his life in ways that I think helped fuel his anger, his fear of abandonment, his low self-esteem, things like that. But also, if as me, as a child of deaf adults, it empowered me in many ways because I was interpreting for my grandparents and sometimes even my parents and handling adult duties like making plane reservations or scheduling appointments and things like that at a very, very young age. I've been flying alone since I was 5 years old without any hesitation, like no fear. And it's because I was very independent as a young child, in charge over authority figures. And I guess it just instilled a level of confidence, and especially as a girl, that a life without deaf parents, I wouldn't have had the same confidence. I'm not sure that I would anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds like in the later portions of the book that confidence that you acquired growing up, you know, once you finally sort of escaped Texas, that really kind of propelled you forward, even if it didn't propel you forward towards writing right away.
Right.
It did at least move you forward.
Yeah, because after the attack on my mom, I never went to college, and I had graduated summa cum laude. There's no reason I shouldn't have gone, but I didn't know how to ask for help. Like, now I realize how ridiculous it is that I didn't just march into the guidance counselor's office and say, hey, I've got these applications, and I'm overwhelmed, and I don't know how to do it. But I didn't have the tools to ask for help because in a lot of abusive households, you're taught to not talk about what's happening in the family. And my mom very much She was very proud of the fact that we never asked for help for like food stamps when we could have used them and we would have been eligible for them. We never asked for help in that regard. And so our trailer got repossessed and they filed bankruptcy and the IRS was after us. But my mom never wanted to ask for help. And I was her daughter and I was taught to never ask for help. Now I see that I should have. So without a college education, but with all this confidence and knowing that, oh, if you want something done, you just do it. Just do it. Like, what's stopping you? And so I've had many careers. I was an assistant vice president of a bank when I was 26, 27 years old with no education. Mm-hmm. I just kind of taught myself how to foreclose. And I had a paralegal degree. I got an associate's degree at a night school. Nothing fancy. Mm-hmm. The Academy of Court Reporting and Paralegal Studies. It's no Ivy League, I just kind of worked my way up through the banking industry as a teller and then a secretary and then a paralegal. And then suddenly I'm like foreclosing on $5-6 million loans and handling really hard, very complicated legal transactions and commercial buildings. I would be in charge of the property management of them and stuff. And it never dawned on me that I couldn't do it. I don't know why. I guess that is a child of deaf adults thing. I don't know.
And you mentioned at the beginning about how the origins of this book came from writing that essay originally for Glamour and then ending up at Fresh Yarn. Mm-hmm. And when it comes time to expand that essay into the memoir, what's it like for you to sort of really go back? And I don't know, maybe for the first time to really sort of like go back and process those emotions of growing up.
You know, the hardest scene for me to write was actually not even the attack on my mom. Sure, that was, you know, emotional writing it, and you've got to really put yourself in that state of mind again and immerse yourself in fear and all those emotions that you had. But the hardest scene for me to write was actually about me vandalizing my friend's house. That was one of the most disgusting things I've ever done. I was like 13 years old. Our trailer had just gotten repossessed, and I had a lot of anger and frustrations that I just kind of took out. And it was just a heinous act. And after I had gotten caught, after the vandalism, I got caught, and we went to like a kangaroo court the neighborhood put together, and I got in trouble with them, had to clean up the mess, and then that was it. I never told a soul the rest of my life. So having to relive that and scenes like that that I have just put back and put away and never to be looked at again, resurrecting those were actually a lot tougher than I imagined. But luckily I had a lot of pictures, and my mother was willing to field hundreds of questions I wanted to make sure that my memories matched up with hers, and sometimes they didn't, but for the reasons that, like, you and I might have a different recollection of a certain event. Mm-hmm. So that didn't bother me, because I just remember things a little different. But whenever it was a factual thing, like a year, or the name of the company she worked at, or things I might be confused about because I was a little kid, she would, you know, help me out with that, and I was lucky to have her there.
Right, and in terms of the sort of the bigger stuff, I mean, this was the first time that your mom had really sort of talked about this openly with you as well, in terms of the research, as you were doing the research.
Yeah, the only time that she ever really talked about it again was on the witness stand, on the trial. The trial had already taken place to prosecute my father for this attempted murder, the attack that just happened about 10 years ago. On Helen, my mom and I were going to be called as witnesses for the prosecution. They didn't care who went, me or her. They just needed somebody from the 1988 attack. And my mom went in my place, because they wanted me. I'm easy to find. My name, Cambry Cruz, is pretty unusual, and they found me right away. But she went in my place and testified, and she had vague recollections of it. But she weirdly kind of defended my dad a little bit. He had already been found guilty, so she was there for the punishment phase. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I don't know, I just saw him, he looked so old and frail, and he didn't have any family or anyone there to support him. She just felt bad and sorry for him. And that's part of his charm and manipulative skills. He's a master manipulator. And even though she hadn't seen him in over 20 years, seeing him there, it all came back to her. And she ended up saying really nice things about him. It's really remarkable. But yeah, she doesn't, it's not something she ever really talked about ever.
And I mean, certainly that kind of, I think that quality of his personality, you know, continues to show through in, you know, the handful of contemporary scenes in the memoir where, I mean, you still go to prison to visit him.
Yeah.
Periodically.
Yeah. He's manipulating me to this day. He, you know, he tricked me into smuggling in Juicy Fruit. Didn't trick me. I mean, he asked for it, but he asked for it in a way that was like, oh, he just wants some gum. Isn't that cute? And it turns out, no, gum sells for $1 a stick, and he had had this plan to smuggle it in and sell it. Mm-hmm. And so he manipulated me successfully. Luckily now, I see through him a lot easier, and I can see where he's headed in letters. And because he's deaf, we communicate with letters only. So I have time to absorb and really read through what he wants, and it's harder for him to manipulate via longhand letters.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, every memoir, you know, there's an obligation to get things right, but you know, I think maybe because there's this criminal case component involved to this case. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, at least from a legal standpoint, in terms of you submitting the memoir for publication, mm-hmm. there must have been some additional sort of like pressure to, you know, to have everything lined up.
And, you know, they didn't ask for much in that regard. I had done the research myself just for my own satisfaction, because when I had started writing that essay, it was not that long after the James Fry shakedown, controversy, and so I wanted to make sure, doubly sure and triply sure on certain things. And so I had ordered the trial transcript. So I have the entire transcript of the attempted murder case, and then also the arrest records and all the witness testimony. There's all handwritten, it's all part of the file. So I ordered all that too. And then back from 1988, I got the criminal. That a lot of it's now been destroyed because it is such an old case. Like they had already destroyed the 911 tape, which I was so sad about. But in a way, I was kind of happy because I wasn't sure I wanted to hear myself that scared at 16, 17 years old, you know. But the case, you know, still exists. It's still on his record. And so I've got a truncated report of that. And it very clearly states the year and the witness is me and how old we are and where we lived and all that stuff. So I had all those things, and they did ask for them during the legal review process. But I was actually surprised at how easy that process was. They're not there to fact check, mm-hmm. is what I discovered, and I thought they were. So I was like ready. I was ready for the facts. I'm psyched.
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked before today's conversation when we mm-hmm. were lining up the interview, because as a historical footnote, for those of you listening, we're having this conversation about a week or so after the revelations about Mike Daisy and This American Life, mm-hmm. where it turns out that his monologue about going to the Apple factory in China turns out to have a lot of distortions and factual inaccuracies. You know, he conflates things that he heard about with things that he saw, for example. And, you know, we had talked about, aside from like sort of the legal obligations of accuracy, the sort of moral or ethical obligations of truth telling in personal storytelling of this kind.
Mm-hmm. A lie is predicated on the fact that nobody will find out. And I think that he's in China, and it's a very, very large country with billions of people. I'm not sure that he realized how easy Kathy would be, Kathy being the interpreter that helped him. I don't think he realized how easy it would be to track her down out of all the billions of people in China. Seems so exotic in such a faraway land. Here I am here in America talking about people who are alive. My mother, my brother, me, my father, you know. Like when I was a kid, I lied about being related to Jose Cruz, which My name's spelled differently. I'm clearly not Hispanic. He is, you know, but I was able to get away with it because I was 8 years old. The internet didn't exist, and the kids didn't know how to spell. I mean, like, it's predicated on the fact that nobody's going to be able to figure this out. And in the age of the internet, and when you're writing about living people, it's just I don't understand how that ends up happening. I'm very confused by it. And every storytelling show that I've ever gone to, every workshop I've ever taken, one of which was taught by Mike Daisy himself, never has it been insinuated that you would expand or exaggerate or lie in any form or fashion. So I'm a little surprised by it. But
yeah, and I think that, you know, there's an interesting spectrum to be explored there. And you're certainly in a position to talk about this, in that, you know, there's a performative aspect to memoir writing, to storytelling on stage, and to the stand-up comedian work that you do. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all various forms of storytelling, mm-hmm. and of creating a voice and sort of articulating that voice out to a larger audience, whether it's on stage or on the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, it's like these people are alive. The only person I think that would ever be like, oh, that didn't happen, would be my brother, and it's because he was a drug addict. He has no recollection of some years of his life where he was homeless and strung out, and I think he would probably, I know he has blocked out certain parts of his life, but there are also, again, documented parts of his life as well. We had to send him away to a detox camp, and you know, we all lived it together, living people. If my mother were dead and she wasn't able to back me up, I guess it might be an issue. But yeah, we all lived it together. I don't see how you could change it, or why you would. The story is there, and that apple story was there. It is all based in fact. So why insert yourself into things that didn't happen? I don't know.
Speaking of you know, the other people in the story accepting your version of events, mm-hmm. Does your brother sort of accept your version of the abuse that you suffered?
He doesn't want to read it, actually. My sister-in-law has read to him the parts that she knows that he'll really enjoy, but he doesn't want to know about this darker side of him. It's a really painful, and took a lot of work for him to get sober, mm-hmm. and to remain sober. And also, he wasn't there to witness my dad's attack on my mom.
Sure.
And I think it's just too dark and ugly for him to open those old wounds. And, you know, his fragile sobriety would be at risk. I think it's just too much for him to take. But, you know, and he's not, my brother isn't a major character in it. But yeah, he, as far as the abuse that he gave me, I think he doesn't quite fully understand how much I hated it and how awful it was. He thinks it's funny still, and that surprises me. I'm like, it wasn't funny to me then, and it's not funny to me now.
And now that you've told this story and you've gotten it down on paper and it's out in the world, do you intend to continue writing?
Yeah, I used to blog every day. You know, in GeoCities, do you remember GeoCities?
I remember GeoCities.
I had a blog before the word blog existed, so I just called it my daily diary or online diary. I used to write every day, and writing the book was such an exhausting, intense process for me. I fell out of the blogging habit, and I want to build that habit again, because I read back on some things and I'm like, oh, that's really funny, or that's a really interesting thought. I should do something with that. I do think that there is a second book to follow up with the 10 years of my dad's life in prison. He's up for parole in June. Even if he doesn't get it in June, which I don't think he will, unless he dies in prison, he will get out. Mm-hmm. He wasn't sentenced to life. And so I think that'd be a very interesting process to witness, and how does a deaf man who's been in jail for 20 years come out and learn how to use an iPhone? He's never seen an iPhone, or he doesn't know what a blog is. He asked me what a blog was. He knows what it is now because he asked me, like, what's a blog? I keep seeing it in the newspaper, and what does that mean? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So having to learn stuff. But also, technology has come a long way in for the deaf community. he will really, his life will be remarkably different from when he's out versus when he went in.
Yeah, that's one of the things that you touch upon in the book, is that, you know, before the advent of the internet and especially email, you know, the old TTY machines, mm-hmm. That allowed deaf people to type to each other over the telephone. Mm-hmm. They were huge machines, it sounds like.
Ours was enormous. It was just this, it was about 3.5-4 feet off. No, that's like, yeah, about 4.5 feet off the ground. It was huge. It shook the whole trailer. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, they're tiny little desktop things, but people don't even necessarily need those as much as they do because of texting and everything. Mm-hmm. They still need them to call businesses and to conduct business, but video relays, or like you and I might Skype, but they've been using video chatting and video relays for years. And so it's like the hearing world is actually a little behind in technology from the deaf world. They seized the opportunity when beepers were first coming out. They were using that to text to each other. So they've been using beepers as texting tools long before. I remember getting my first text. I was in the back of a cab going over the 59th Street Bridge into Queens from Manhattan, and I got a text. I'm like, what is this? And why would anybody just write? Why wouldn't they just write me an email? Like, why would you text me? I don't get it. Oh, this is so weird. And now, of course, we all text, but yeah. But deaf people have been texting for forever. Yeah.
And apart from this possible second nonfiction book, is there any other maybe fiction writing that you want to try?
I thought maybe young adult stuff, because children of deaf adults, and this is something I'm learning now with as the book is making its rounds around the deaf community. There are so many children who are put in positions of interpreting for their families, that not just deaf families, but where English is the second language. And I think that maybe writing a book geared towards children in that regard. Also, I want to do a solo show, a performance piece that's based on the book, because sign language is a visual language. It's not a written language. And a lot of the story would benefit from being told on stage, and it would open it up for the deaf community a little more. Like, I wrote the book in a way that is easy to read for the deaf community. A lot of deaf, and not all, of course, I don't want to generalize, but many deaf, the reading comprehension level is about fourth grade, and so I wanted it to be an accessible, easy-to-read book that for the deaf community to enjoy as well. So, yeah. But it should be on stage, though, I think.
Great. Well, we will definitely look forward to seeing that.
Thank you.
So this has been Life Stories. I'm Ron Hogan, and I've been talking with Cambry Cruz, the author of Burn Down the Ground, which is published by Villard and out now. So go out and take a look for it. And keep an eye out for the next Life Stories podcast on Beatrice.com. Thanks.